Welcome to the Odyssey Podcast. This is Jean Cavellos, Director of Odyssey. Odyssey is an intensive 6-week workshop for writers of fantasy, science fiction, and horror whose work is approaching publication quality. Odyssey is held each summer on the campus of St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire. Adult writers from all over the world apply. Only 16 are admitted. Top authors, editors, and agents serve as guest lecturers. For more information, visit www.odysseyworkshop.org. Podcast number 4 is an excerpt from a lecture Robert J. Sawyer gave at Odyssey in the summer of 2006 on Point of View. The text of this recording is copyright 2006 by Robert J. Sawyer. The sound recording is copyright 2007 by Odyssey Writing Workshops.
The great strength of printed fiction is going inside a character's head and hearing his or her thoughts. It works really well in printed fiction. In fact, it is the most powerful thing, the most powerful tool we have when we are doing printed fiction is actually entering a character's head and hearing the stream of consciousness that goes on between their ears. And it never works in any other medium. And Blade Runner, the original edition, is a classic example of that. It falls flat every time they try to do it. Why we choose to do this kind of stuff, what we do, printed fiction, instead of writing scripts, one of the main reasons is because we have a tool that nobody else in the storytelling business has. And that tool is limited point of view. Limited point of view. There are two kinds of limited point of view, first person and third person. There's also second person. Don't ever write in second person, all right? Irritating. Make people mad. You did this, you did that. No, I didn't. Shut up. Okay? First person or third person are the only standard ways to write fiction. And probably, let's say, 80% of modern science fiction and fantasy are written in third person. The general kind of rule of thumb is, if you don't have to be in first person, don't be in first person, because there are, in most cases, more disadvantages than advantages to first person. The biggest of which, especially if you're writing a heroic character, is it sounds like bragging. So third person is more often advantageous over first person, but still you want to have a limited point of view. Limited means that within each scene, you're only in the head of a single character. You're actually seeing everything that that character could see and nothing else. Why do you want to do that? Why is that so powerful, so much, in many ways, better than what happens in a movie where you're going back and forth? And the answer is, and this is something, another psychological thing that does make a certain amount of sense. We always talk about, when we're talking about characterization, wanting, people say you need to have a likable protagonist. I don't 100% agree with that, but it's commonly said in critiques. I didn't like your protagonist. I didn't care about your protagonist. I didn't get into your story. The way you get into a story and the way you get to like almost anybody is you walk in their shoes. You become identified with them. That's the actual psychological term, identification. You identify with the other person. The best way in fiction to identify with this person who is not you is actually to climb inside their head. They used to say in discussions of human consciousness, they were trying to figure out where consciousness is, and the term that was always bandied around is homunculus. There was a little man, a homunculus, somewhere inside your head looking out through these two windows. And think of that, of what you're doing with point of view. It's not actually true. That's not how consciousness really works, but it's a really good metaphor for what the writer is trying to do. You're grabbing the reader and say, come here, homunculus, and cramming him inside Terry's head, whipping him around, poking out Terry's eyes and letting the little homunculus look through the two holes in Terry's poor dead bleeding skull. That's how you create identification. The homunculus, which is the reader, the guy who paid the $10 for your book, has become Terry. Terry, you can torture and do all kinds of awful things to, because that's what they paid for, the experience to become somebody else, and they know at the end they'll be able to withdraw from it. But only at the end do you let them withdraw. You lose all the strength that you're endowed with as a fiction writer, the strength that the filmmaker doesn't have in the scenes between, let's say, Harrison Ford and Rutger Hauer in Blade Runner. You're not Harrison Ford, and you're not Rutger Hauer. You are a spectator. You are not, in fact, involved in the scene because your perspective keeps bouncing back and forth. It's like watching a sporting event. You may be rooting for one team, but you don't, in fact, become that one team. You're watching both teams actions and activities. In fiction, you do become the character, and you want to stay in that character. And that identification is the most powerful emotional bond we can have with another person. It's not just, I like you. It's not just, I think I have a clue as who you might be. It is, I am you. And you violate that at your peril. And that's why point of view violations are so important. It may be that the reader can't even articulate or isn't even consciously aware that there's been a viewpoint violation. But nonetheless, the effect is they no longer are in that character. They are out of the story. You've distanced them a bit, and you've lost the power that you had by choosing to be a print writer, and you've gone back to being just a filmmaker. Right? And you don't want to be just a filmmaker, because setting aside all the money and the women and or men and the fame and the mansion in Hollywood and all of that, you'll never know the joy of seeing your hardcover book sold for $1.99 on the remainder table of Barnes & Noble. So you don't want to become a filmmaker because you'll miss out on the joys of life. You want to be a writer, and you're going to use all the powerful tools that the writers have, and the most powerful one is that point of view issue. I want to start with a little exercise here. I'm going to hand out a page here which has on it six examples of point of view violations that are subtle. Everybody got one? Okay. Carl's point of view. Carl, perhaps for the first time, noticed the strong texture of the doctor's hands. A reflection of the man, he thought. The doctor was stronger than Carl could ever hope to be. There is a point of view violation in that sentence, or those pairs of sentences. Deborah.
Is it perhaps for the first time?
Yes, it is. And why is that a violation?
Because Carl wouldn't be thinking about, he doesn't stop to think, you know, I've never noticed this for the first time, you know, the strong textures. He's noticing the strong textures, and it's the narrator pointing out to the reader that that this is different from Carl's previous observations.
You are close. You had your hand up second. Did you have a...
It was a different one. The doctor was stronger than Carl could ever hope to be. How would he know that?
Oh, that's a personal assessment. I don't think that's a point of view violation. I could certainly, if I walk into the presence of, you know, a brilliant writer, and I've just heard him do a reading, I could easily say to myself, you know, that Kevin J. Anderson is better than I could ever hope to be. Unlikely, but it could happen. Yes?
I think it's a perhaps, because he would know that it was the first.
That's right. You went a little too far with it. That's the key. The power of limited, in this case, third-person point of view. You're limited, you're constrained to just Carl's point of view. The power of it is you actually know all those things that Carl knows, and only those things. And Carl would know whether or not this was the first time. And it's perfectly reasonable to say to myself, if I walked into this room, you know, and said to myself, there's Liz, and I never noticed that Liz had whatever those little blue T's, letter T's on her sandals. I never noticed that before. Holy cow, right? That's a perfectly valid observation. People do that all the time. I never realized that. You could say that yourself, and if you're inside a character who's saying it's perfectly valid to observe that. But the perhaps is not something the character would have thought. That's the author saying, well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. The character would know whether it was the first time he'd ever noticed the strong hands. So these really subtle things can pull you right out of it without you even being aware that you're out of it, because subtly there, you weren't Carl anymore. Subtly there, you were whoever it was who was pulling the strings for Carl, writing the story. Carl, if it had read, Carl, for the first time, noticed the strong texture of the doctor's hands. A reflection of the man, he thought. The doctor was stronger than Carl, than I could ever hope to be. Perfectly fine point of view. You're 100% with Carl. That perhaps was the error there. Number two says, and this is from Larry's point of view, Larry looked up with his most indecipherable expression. He wanted to be polite, of course. He did not want to insult the preacher as he had during their first visit.
The most indecipherable expression, because how in the world would Larry know his expression's indecipherable?
Exactly. Exactly. Now, we talked about, and Deborah did raise an interesting point about how you salvage a line like this. How can you salvage this? He cannot know that it's his most indecipherable expression. The whole point of sitting inside Terry's head and peeking out of the holes where his eyes used to be is you can't see Terry's face, right? You don't know. You can intend. You can have your intent. You can say, Larry looked up at him with what he hoped was an indecipherable expression. Larry tried to muster the best poker face he could. Larry tried to compose his features, but he can't, nobody has the ability to rate all the expressions they do on a scale of 1 to 10. This is by reasonably indecipherable expression. You don't know. Most people, in fact, don't know. Most people are not, in fact, aware of when they're, of the subtle facial expressions they do. They can be aware that they're smiling or grinning. Few people are aware that they're actually suppressing a smirk when it's happening, for instance. Number three here, Juan's point of view. Juan looked at the strange ball he'd just been handed. The ball was made of old woolen socks tied tightly around a stone and woven together with carpenter's string. For those who are curious, it is in fact an old baseball. Liz.
How did he know that the stone was in the middle?
Exactly. There's no way he could possibly know that. This is so hard to keep track of when you are writing stories, because you spend so much of your time is staring at a screen or staring off into space, and what you actually have to be doing is really you yourself getting into the character. You have to say to yourself, okay, I want to hand him a baseball. Ask yourself what, you know, do the mental list of questions. What will it feel like in my hand? What will I see? What does it smell? Maybe it's made out of old leather. It smells. Excuse me. Old woolen socks. It smells even worse in this case. Ask yourself what the sensory experience is going to be. What this writer did here was said to himself, okay, so the character is going to hand another character a baseball, and what is a baseball like? That's not the right question. The question is, what will the character perceive when he is handed this object? It's very, very tight intellectual process for the writer. You have to stay very, very focused. You have to stay being the homunculus inside the head. This is Sally's point of view. Sally looked at Krikor. Her heart was pounding and her face was flushed with anger. Krikor was angry too. Adria?
Well, the face flushed. She can't see her own face.
That is true. Deborah?
I would actually disagree with that, since you can feel your face flushed
yes. With
heat, but the Krikor was angry.
Yes. I would say that's it's an interesting judgment call. Because you could say, I don't think that if you're doing this yourself, you're acting out the scene in your head, I actually can tell when I'm flush. I can tell. I'm like Deborah. I can feel there's a heat associated with it. So it's something that I'm aware of in a way that there are other expressions that I might not be aware of. I would not have thrown a flag on the play there. I would not have said, okay, point of view violation. I can understand how somebody can think they feel that. However, what works for one writer might not work for another. Adria might be extremely right in saying that that's a point of view violation. If she's not comfortable writing that, then don't write that. You have a follow-up.
I think the reason why I feel that is it's the way it's worded.
Yes.
It's the was flushed, as if she's looking at herself in the mirror and can see it.
Yes, okay.
So
And you're right to be bothered about it. I'm going to come on to why I think it's still passable here. And this is another issue, because the flip side is you can also so burden your prose with words that are designed to make sure that you're saying, see here, no point of view violation. And so whenever you do something, it is possible that you think, okay, I have to overly compensate here and say, Sally looked at Krikor, her heart was pounding, and she felt her face flush with anger. Which is a way of making abundantly clear the point, but if you are like Deborah and believe that you can sense it anyways, it may not be necessary every single time. Because if you do it every single time, your prose ends up starting to get flabby. So you have a trade-off here. It's a subtle one. This is a tricky one. And both of you are right. Both of you could say, if it was Adria's story, she might say, I got to revise this. And if it's Deborah's story, she might say, I'm not going to revise this. And at the end, both of you could defend your choices here. The point of view violation, in my estimation, is the second sentence. In part because it isn't technically a point of view violation, but it's the failure to exercise the power of point of view. Krikor was angry too. You could argue that it's not a point of view violation because it might be blindingly obvious that he's angry. But there's no way the reader knows that, right? Normally, we don't know in our day-to-day lives, except maybe for our most intimate companions, when they are faking and when they are actually expressing a genuine emotion. So we come back to these weasel words of point of view here, and whether they're always necessary or not, but I think here they are. She has given us, we have been given by the author, a vivid description of Sally's anger, and what I would have preferred to see. It's very easy for Sally, if it's her point of view, to assert, I'm angry. I don't need to know anything else because I am the reliable arbiter of what my emotional state is. I'm angry. I know that. Krikor, I'm not so sure about. I'm not in his head. It's Krikor that I wanted to see the subtle descriptions that allow you to conclude that he's angry. Krikor's face flushed. That's a sign that he's angry. She couldn't tell about Krikor's heart rate, but she could tell about a change in Krikor's tone of voice, a balled fist, etc., etc. Here we were given the point of view stuff, signposts that we needed for the character that was being observed, were instead freighted onto the character who could simply have made the assertion. We get the assertion for the wrong character, and we get the signposts for the wrong character. It should, if you're only going to do it for one, it should have been the other way around. Here are the things that allow me to conclude that that person is almost certainly angry, and that almost certainly is, they could be faking. One of the powers, of the limited point of view is as the story develops, it may appear that Krikor is furious, and you can give us all the clues that would make the reader conclude without a second thought that Krikor is furious. And then it turns out later, ha-ha, Krikor was just fooling. That's usable and valid, and it's a turnaround if we've only been given a list of clues. If you say Krikor was furious too, there is no possibility you have become a cheater as a writer if later it turns out, no, he wasn't really. I said declaratively that he was. If you say, here's the list of reasons and allow the reader to connect the dots, then it's not definitive and you always have at your disposal the possibility of reversing that.
The text of this recording is copyright 2006 by Robert J. Sawyer. The sound recording is copyright 2007 by Odyssey Writing Workshops.